Anyway, I have just started grading all of your midterm projects, and if all goes well, they will all be graded sometime first couple days of next week. I am using a evaluation form which is very similar to that used by a standard reviewer for any conference. The only difference is that the reviewers usually give you grades of 0 through 5. I will give you A, B, C, D, E. No, sorry, no E's. I think just A, B, C. I didn't allow for any provision for D's and F's. But don't push me. Okay, so that's the update there. The other thing is I want to remind you about final projects. We're giving you a lot more freedom to choose a final project. And I've had a couple of you actually talk to me already about final projects. So if you've got some thoughts, anything in that list really sounded interesting, or if you've got an idea for something else, but it is related to image processing, particularly for vehicle driving or something like that, which has been the theme that we've been using, let me know. Okay? Yes, Phil?
Were the images going through Lakeview Cemetery ever?
I don't know. In fact, that's on my list that I've got to check with Scott, because I thought that was going to have been done a week ago. I'll tell Scott that he gets no letters of recommendation until I get those images. And if there's any other particular type of image that you think we need more of for a project you're interested in, also let me know. Yes. Well, actually, we may have to turn you loose to collect your own data. By the way, has anyone checked out the Friedman Center over in the library? They have camcorders that you can sign out, I believe, for a 2-day period. So if you want to, I personally don't recommend that you collect the data by yourself. But if you would like to get your partner, your wife, your son, or someone to hold the camera, or alternately drive the vehicle, at least in a legal manner, there's nothing wrong with collecting some more specific data. For stop signs, it could even be still images. And by the way, there's probably a lot of Google images of stop signs. And if you want more images of stop, well, I have a couple thoughts as to where we could get a bunch.
Yeah, I took some this morning coming into work. Just, camera with like an auto snapping feature.
Okay. As long as you were driving responsibly. Very responsibly. Okay. Remember, you probably had to drive through Cleveland Heights.
No, I have one right outside my house. So.
Oh, okay.
I just, pulled up to that first stop, just
okay. Very reasonable. Okay. Any other questions on the projects? I'm going to actually think about and post a due date for them. And I noticed that the webpage has XX for the due date, but it'll probably be something on the order of 12th through 15th. That'll be a little bit into finals week. It'll give you a little bit extra time. But the drop-dead deadline for me to get your grades in is the 22nd. Anything getting too close to that, and I'll have no time to grade them. Or at least to give you the credit that you will so well deserve.
Wasn't there a date in the email that you sent?
There may be. I've got to go back and check, but it's something on that order. I think I may have picked the Friday of the first week of finals or something like that. Could be. But it would be something in that order anyway, because we don't want to get too close to finals. And that's where I'm going to be working very hard to get you feedback on your papers from the midterm so that you'll have a better idea of what your grade is. And I've got to take a look if I put Scott's last grades for all the homework into the backboard. No? Oh, then I'm pretty sure he sent them to me, and I've just forgotten to do that. I'll do that. I don't want to promise everything tomorrow. I'll probably do it Thursday or Friday. Any questions about the final project or anything else? Though the final is actually a little bit more negotiable than the midterm. I sort of put out that email as a bargaining point, where the opening bid, and I'm open to suggestions. For example, Bill probably wants to find only all octagonal stop signs in red that are 6.5 feet above the ground. You know, that would, well, I'm being a little sarcastic there. That would be a little bit too much. But I'm modestly negotiable. Those were given as starting ideas. And in fact, if anyone has an idea which is somewhat related but more similar to something they might be doing for their master's thesis or their research, we can talk about that too. Midterm was to get you all on the same track. You know, and I have no problem if someone comes up with, for example, a Kalman filter estimator that detects moving vehicles and drives Dexter into them. Well, nah. But actually, that's a quite challenging project. And actually fits a little bit into what we're going to talk about today. Any others? Any thoughts? Everyone can tell John about the surprise quiz that we had. Everyone wrote down their name. No, we're just kidding. Okay. Well, we're going to finish up this little side trip that we took into Kalman filters today. This is a little bit more along the lines of what you actually do with them. And this is actually a really nice presentation that I added to. If you take a look on the web, there are actually a number of schools that will have lectures to accompany their image processing classes, their computer vision classes. This actually comes out of a computer vision class at the University of Nottingham in England. And this is actually, I forget what the name of the center is. Oh, Image Processing and Interpretation Center. And I believe it's in their computer science department. This is what the problem is all about. And actually, Kalman filters get used for a lot of things. One of which, by the way, is to integrate data. Like, for example, GPS data with map data or actual positional information. In this case, this is just, I mean, we're not exactly interested in this problem, but it's actually just tracking the corner of a truck. Okay. And there's actually, these guys publish a lot of other related papers, but this was just fairly done. And this is the kind of thing that you might be looking for if we were integrating GPS with inertial navigation systems. And in fact, there's a number of papers on that on the web in the IEEE database. But for this restrictive thing, we've got vehicles. They're moving around. They're going to have some features that we can lock onto. And obviously the best feature would be to have a giant bullseye painted on the back of the truck or something. You know, that would be a really good feature. Or if all of our colors, like I don't know how many times you get behind a Mr. Yellow, you know, the yellow trucks, or the orange moving trucks. You know, if you have something that would identify it, it would be great. And we'll talk about ways that you can do that. But in this case, we simply want to track trucks. We don't know their exact position. That's the thing that changes over time. And we don't know their exact velocity. But what we want to do is be able to predict where it's going to be. And it turns out Kalman filtering is very good for that. We're going to make some assumptions. They are moving with a quote-unquote fairly constant velocity. The big thing which you'll see when I start writing the matrices is we're going to assume time steps of one. So for this exercise, that'll probably be 1 second, but it could be 1 millisecond or whatever. Those are the physical units. And we have to have something that we can measure. It can be, you know, if we had GPS and an inertial navigation system, you've got positional data. It could be information from other sensors. And I'm going to show this for positions and velocities, but it could be used for a lot of other things that you may want to estimate just in terms of temporal data, something completely different from this. Okay, and I jumped ahead, and what we are going to track is the lower left-hand corner of the top of the truck. Now, the problem isn't that bad, but when you start to see the math, it's going to start, oh, this is very simple. This is just getting started. There's nothing to this. Basically, we're going to describe the state of that lower left-hand corner of the vehicle by its position, x and y, and by the velocity of that point, u and v. So the state, okay, is a four vector. X position, y position, x velocity, y velocity. And these will be the update equations. And here's the key thing. There's nothing multiplying the velocity, so your units aren't right. But we're assuming, notice, we're going from, and these are t's, by the way. That's t, and this is t minus 1. So for the moment, we're going to assume that the time step is 1. You could compensate for that in real units. Okay, and so you see what's going to happen is once you've written your state update equation, then I can write that in the form of a matrix. Everything's going to be done in the form of a matrix, and A is going to be the state update equation. But you need to express your problem in terms of some kind of state. And by the way, this is all going to be on the web. This one I may have a chance to do over the long weekend coming up. Okay, now, here's a subtle difference, okay? What I had previously was the state, okay? The state of the objects characterized by a four vector, but we don't have any direct method of reading out the velocity. What we're going to do is we're simply going to measure the positions. And so we take our state vector, and we can calculate the position, okay? And this will be a measurement matrix, H. And the little m's will actually indicate measurements, okay? Now, you have to start someplace. And it turns out this is really statistical. So you can make some good guesses. And what you're going to do is the following. The initial state is from some known position. And what are we using for position? We're not even using real x and y, that is in world coordinates. What we're doing is we're using x and y in pixel coordinates. So what we would have in this particular problem is the trajectory in our image of the lower left-hand corner of the truck. Okay, you could transfer that and do it really in world coordinates, and you may want to do that. And we don't have any good idea what the velocity is. And we're going to assume that the velocity is moderately constant, you know, that we're not accelerating like mad to beat a light or anything like that. Not that anyone in here would do anything like that. Okay. Now, since it's all statistical, we get into the uncertainty. Okay. And there's a couple kinds of uncertainty in here. The first one is that we're going to have estimates of all of the elements in the state vector. X position, Y position, X velocity, Y velocity. Okay? And we're going to have an uncertainty associated with each one. And guess what? We want to represent the uncertainties as a covariance matrix. You're going to find that this covariance matrix comes up in pretty much everything. Okay? And I won't get into a whole lot here because you already know about the covariance matrix, but what we're talking about as a covariance matrix, in this case, we have four variables, and we would have X, Y, U, and Z, positions and velocities. And so when we talk about a covariance matrix, for example, this component right here, which would be the 1-2 component, would be the expected value of X minus X bar times Y minus Y bar. Okay. Now, remember, how do you compute variances? How do you compute mean? Well, usually you need more than one data point. So far, we've only come up with the first data point, and we've just guessed at it. Okay, so we may have to give some initial estimate of variances. Okay, now, we've got two. That's just uncertainty in the state. It turns out now there's two kinds of noise in the process. And this is actually a subtle point. We usually put the two together. One is the measurement noise. Okay, I probably can't measure something better than maybe half a pixel. You know, the best I could do is maybe interpolate between pixels. And it might even be just one pixel, nearest pixel. That's okay, but we have to start with something. So we have measurement noise, D, and we're going to have white noise. This is just the noise in the process. Velocities, you know, unless we're using a cruise controller, velocity might vary a little bit. There's going to be a little uncertainty in our position. Because remember, what is the model? It's a variable plus white noise. That's what we actually measure. And this is the white noise. We assume that they have zero mean. And I'll show you what the covariance matrices for the different noises look like, but they're going to be a little bit different. Okay? And we'll get to that. Okay. We want to estimate the process noise, and you could argue what should it be for your particular application. These are just reasonable things that he picked out for his particular experiment, which was these trucks driving down a highway. Okay, that's not a lot of noise. He figures that the first estimate is accurate to within a couple pixels. That would be how well you've located the corner of the vehicle. And that's okay. So say the variance is 3. The velocity, now this is not something that you read directly off of pixel coordinates. You're just sort of making a guess here and saying, how well do we know it? And by the way, if you're off on this, it turns out all the statistics will update themselves automatically. That's what the Kalman filter does. Because it's recursive, it generates updated matrices. All of these are initial estimates. Oh. One thing here I do want to mention. Q, which is the noise matrix, that's a 4x4, just like this. M, which is the measurement noise, is only going to be 2x2. Why? Because we only measured X and Y. We weren't measuring U and V. So you can have more variables in your state than you measure. Okay. Yes, Bill. That was the measurement, I think that was the H matrix. Okay, but there are only two variables that we measure. And so what you would have here is this would be XY by XY. You'd have an RXX, a RYY, an RXY, and an RYX. So this would be the covariance. Well, technically, these would really be C's, not R's. Okay. But yes, these would be covariance matrices. All of this is covariance. This is for the noise. And this will be for the state variables. Everything is statistics based. Right now, what's more important is that you simply understand how we started up, what we put where, and then you'll see how the algorithm goes. And we're not going to get into all of the details of the algorithm, but you know, as we talked about, it is a state estimator. Okay. The a priori estimate matrix. Okay. These are our initial estimates of variance. In other words, they're sort of guesses. Okay? And what's going to happen then, as soon as we start making measurements, this will get updated every time we make a measurement, and eventually it'll be real statistics of our data. Okay? So these are the state variables, and there's going to be a little assumption here. A priori means it's before we make a measurement. So we're going to have before a measurement and after a measurement. By the way, if any of you are interested in doing some Kalman filtering for your final project for the course, let me know. I can tell you the really good references and the not so good references. Okay, but this is based upon earlier we guessed that the variance of X and Y, we think that we're locating the position fairly well, and it will be tighter than the velocity. Okay, and that's really all we said. And so we're going to assume a variance of 3, so we'll have 9 in the covariance. It's always the square. And the same thing here. This will be the variances of the velocities, and we figured those are going to be 5 squared 25. And the important thing is our initial assumption is that everything is statistically independent. They're uncorrelated. And again, if we're wrong, all the off-diagonal terms will start filling up as we iterate this matrix. Bill? Well, you could probably pick 0, but this is actually coming a little bit from just past experience. Also, if you pick 0, it's going to take it longer to converge. It's helpful if you come up with moderately realistic. The key thing here is not so much the absolute values of the variances, but the fact that it's pretty reasonable that we expect the velocity to be more noisy than the position. That makes a lot of sense. Pretty much, yes. Now, that's where I said earlier, you can decide whether you're going to, for example, track something in image coordinates, which means you're stuck with, like, you know, X and Y, 0 to 511 or whatever, or if what you're going to do is do it in real world, like XYZ coordinates. For example, if we were doing GPS and an inertial tracker, we would want that in real world coordinates, probably. You know, pixel coordinates would be meaningless. In this case, we just have one camera looking down, and so we just want to know how things are moving across the screen. This is a really simple problem. Okay? It's much more interesting in real-world coordinates. And by the way, you don't have to pick X and Y and U and V. In fact, if you take a look at a lot of the papers that this particular center publishes, they actually, instead of tracking corners, they'll actually track lines. And what you could do is your state variable could instead be, you know, if you wanted to put in r and theta, maybe a line in polar coordinates, or it could be a slope and a y-intercept, in, okay, or something fancier. So you can apply this to any type of variables that describe the state of a system. Could be aircraft. Could be all kinds of things. There you'd have a z component as well. Okay, but the key thing here is everything off diagonal is zero, meaning that we're assuming they're uncorrelated, and, you know, that's probably not really true. You know, you hit the accelerator, you're going to probably have real you're going to have correlations after a while. And Bill's observation, why not just start with all zeros? Give it something to start with, because you know that for any covariance matrix, you usually don't have zeros on the diagonal. And the reason is, you know, something correlated with itself, even if it's white noise, is going to be an impulse function. Okay, so the autocorrelations along the diagonal, there's always going to be numbers there. It's in the cross correlations that you may have zeros. So you don't want to give the stuff too much trouble to converge. Actually, we sort of talked about that already. And in fact, this fits exactly the point that Bill raised. Choosing the diagonal entries to make it start converging fairly quickly is a little bit more of an art. You've got to use information. Okay. Process noise. Okay. This is really just noise, and it's not going to be a very large amount of noise. In this case, it's just maybe a pixel. In this case, the authors at Nottingham chose half a pixel. So, relatively small error, but it's noise. The measurement error, probably you can only estimate it to half a pixel. There's a subtle difference between noise in the process and noise in measurement. Noise in measurement is simply how accurate. And saying that you can only measure it to the nearest pixel is probably pretty reasonable. You know, you're not attempting to split pixels or do anything. And the noise in the process, you know, what kind of wild variation do you have going on? If it's in cruise control, positions and velocities are probably going to be fairly smooth. If you've got something that's widely, you know, that's really wildly varying, then you would make the noise in the process a lot larger. Okay? Now, here's how you, and what I'm going to do in the next couple slides is basically, here's just how you would run the algorithm. A couple details are left out, but this is the basic process. You've got to start someplace. There's a an initial estimate. Basically, we looked at the image and we ran something. You know, it could be Huff transforms. A very common thing would be to run Huff transforms and get the two lines and where they intersect. That's a corner. There are corner operators. There's all kinds of ways. You probably don't want to be there and making the measurements yourself for each frame. You want an automated system. Okay. And what we want to do is, starting with that, we want to predict where the next point is going to be. Okay? Because the whole idea is, we're going to start with this, and based on all the statistics, we're going to, not guess, but we're going to predict where the next state will be. Then we will actually measure where the next state is. Okay? And then we'll subtract those to get the Kalman gain. That's the recursive part. And then we'll start repeating that process. Okay. So the first thing is, it really doesn't do too much. This was the transformation matrix that we had before. Here is the initial position and velocity. And it says, well, I don't really have any information, okay, since we didn't put in any initial velocities. This is like putting in initial zero covariances, although we shouldn't do that, at least for the diagonal. So we made the velocity zero, which we know is wrong, and it says, oh, well, the best place to look for the next measurement point is right here where I just made a measurement. That's what the minus means. It's before the next measurement. Because we started at zero, but now this is going to be S1, the next state. Okay, this is actually the estimation process now. And this is how we're going to update the covariance matrix. This one. Okay, and this is a standard Kalman filter formula, though that's our noise. This is our original covariance, and this is the state transformation matrix. Okay? And it could be bigger, it could be lower, but this is our estimate. Okay? This is before we make the measurement. Okay? Of now, how the covariance matrix updated, and notice in response to Bill's initial question, there's some stuff coming out here. And it sort of makes sense that positions are going to be related to velocity. Certainly makes sense. The x position is related to the x velocity. Okay, so it's going to start filling in all of those details. Now, we have an estimate of where the next state is. In this case, because the first time through, it's still our initial measurement. But we have an updated covariance matrix, okay, which we just did. And it turns out, if we look at it, okay, our C11, our RXX and our RYY are the same. Okay, so if we think of this statistically, this is a circle. Okay, and what this does is it statistically tells us where to look for the next measurement point. If you remember the picture of the truck, what it's going to do is we're going to use this one. This is our S1 minus. Our guess of where, I shouldn't say guess, our prediction. You know, we're engineers. We get paid for predictions. Okay, so that's our prediction of the next point. And what we're going to do is, since we have all of the variances, we'll just take the square root. That gives us the sigma. That's the width of the distribution. Okay, and we'll pick 2 sigma, which really should account for, you know, something like 95 to 98% confidence that we're going to be looking for the measurement, the next measurement point in that area. We have to find it. Okay? So that's all this is about. Okay, 95%. Okay? And since it's a circle, we just take the square root of that 34, 35. Okay, that's about just under 6 pixels. So we look in a circle of 12 pixels around it. There's all kinds of ways that you can look for feature points. It turns out one of the common ways, if you're looking for corners, is something called a Harris interest operator. There's also things called Moravec interest operators. Basically, what these things do is the following. If you're just looking in a small area, well, let's face it. If it's all uniform, it's not very interesting. There probably is no feature in it. Your features, like, for example, a corner, there's going to be a lot of edges, which means a lot of variance in the data. And so the idea of interest operators is they usually look for variances. Okay, so if I have a lot of change in color at a point, then that's interesting. If I have no change in color, That's not interesting. And so there's a whole bunch of interest operators out there, and I can give you some references to those as well. Or you could just have a plain old corner operator. There's all kinds of ways. This is not critical. So the idea is we measure the next point. We find it. This is our best estimate from looking at the picture at where the corner is. In this case, it moved in X, it increased in X, went down in Y. Okay? Now that we've made the measurement, what we've got to do is we've got to update everything. Because, and that's done through the Kalman game. And this is a complicated expression. It's got your measurement noise. It's got the previous covariance matrix. And it had, okay, our matrix. Okay. And in this case, it still has a lot of off-diagonal components. But as soon as you have the Kalman gain, then we now update the state error covariance matrix. You know, this sounds like a lot of matrices. It sounds like it's really complicated, but you can get toolboxes which have all of this implemented for you. The important thing for you getting started is to understand what's going on. Okay? This now is saying, you notice it doesn't have a minus on it anymore. This was our guess, our prediction of the covariance before we made the measurement. Now that we have a measurement, we're going to update it and make it more accurate. That's what this is doing. You see, it's an iterative update of the statistics of the process. That's where Kalman really had great insight. And then what you can do in general is, instead of, this will be now the new state variable, okay, incorporates all the measurement information in it. So that's the new state variable. And you may say, well, didn't we measure it? Remember, it had velocity in it as well. So it's going to give you a more accurate estimate of X and Y. Remember, we can be predicting, we can be interpolating, or smoothing. Okay, it's coming up with a best fit to all of that. So that's the value. It may not exactly coincide with our measurement. Okay? So it gets updated. The minus meant that was before the measurement. This is now after the measurement. Okay? And this is what we do in general. Now that we have that, we're going to predict where will I look for the next measurement and what's the prediction of the variance. And by the way, it was circular before, but what can happen as this goes on, it can become elliptical. We may not want to look in just a circular area. We may want to look along an axis or something. That will come out in the update of the error covariance. And then basically, you repeat it over and over. Over time, it becomes more accurate. 10 or 20 measurements, depending upon how noisy your process is, you've probably got a very good estimator. Okay, now if you have big jumps in it, remember, this is a statistical thing. So if you keep hitting the brake or doing things like that, that will make it difficult. Okay. You need a lot of matrix subroutines, but those are already done in MATLAB for you. And I would be very surprised if ImageJ didn't have a whole bunch of routines for this already done as well. And it turns out you only need a plus, a minus, a multiply. We don't do divide with matrices. We do a transpose and an inverse. And that's really it. You can set this thing up in matrices, and it runs very, very well. Let's see. I think I've got all the points, the big points. Okay. Now, there's some other stuff, which I'm going to tell you about, But this is just, if you really get into this, the extended Kalman filter, it only works on a linear process. Because, think about it, we're just using matrices. You know, it's a linear combination of the state vector. What you can do, what do you do when you have a nonlinear process? You linearize it. So you can linearize a process over a small region and fit that in, and this is called the extended Kalman filter. Okay? And I'm not going to say anything about it. You're just fitting a linear approximation. And you can put all of that into the state vector, state variable, and you can do things, for example, in this case, they're using a Kalman filter to track all four sides of the vehicle. And here, if you are going to do anything with a Kalman filter, this is a really, really good paper. This is like the paper which everyone references. It's basically, how do you implement a Kalman filter? And it's this technical report, and it turns out that, I think it's Bishop maybe, keeps a very good Kalman filter website on the web. Okay, and it's got all kinds of lectures on Kalman filters, references to code, tutorials, papers, examples. And just doing a quick search for Kalman filter will probably turn up this near the top of your Google list. And I'll put this on the website. You can use the JAMA library, but there probably is a Wiener filter Java implementation somewhere on the web. If you find it, I'll put it on the web page. So that's our little introduction to Kalman filters. There's a lot of Kalman filters out there. They are really, really useful. Okay, and it's really funny in that most of the Kalman filter papers are being published by computer scientists and not systems and control or electrical engineers. Okay, any questions on Kalman filters? John. Yes. It basically, what you're doing is you're measuring and measuring and measuring, and as you get more information, you're coming up with either a better estimate of where you were, a smoothed one, or if you stop and think, you don't have to use exactly that equation that I wrote, that M equals HS. You could actually, for example, on the basis of that, maybe predict further ahead. You know, if you're driving, you might want to really be predicting ahead. A really good application in terms of the DARPA stuff might be, gee, I might want to track something and determine if it's on a collision course. Although it turns out there are far, far probably simpler things. Okay? One of the things is very simple. If something's got a constant bearing, it's coming right at you. But on the other hand, you have to take into account both vehicles are moving. So that might be one application. But the integration of GPS with an inertial navigation system, in fact, these guys have a paper on their website about integrating a cheap inertial navigation system with a GPS. And, you know, that may be something of interest. I don't know enough about relative costs and what does a cheap inertial navigation system mean? You know, $30,000 versus $100,000? I have no idea. To me, cheap is under $10, preferably under a dollar. But I have a funny feeling that's not what they mean. Okay? But what it's really doing is it's iteratively giving you a very good estimate of where you've been, and you can use it for prediction as well. It's not for everything. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Wiener filters or all of these other filters. or other techniques. You know, we'd have one class in Kalman filters, and that would be your education. No, it's not that good.
It's also used
as yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. In fact, I've seen things where they have the sensor in the dome type sensor in the ceiling. And for example, if you are wearing sensors, or rather, if you're wearing, for example, optical emitters or something like that, you can track, you know, motion of people, which is a moderately smooth function until, unless you fall down, most people have moderately smooth movement. So you can use it for a lot of things. It could be used for a chemical process, a control process, all kinds of things. But yeah, tracking of all kinds, even of people, is high on the list of applications. Although it probably wouldn't work very well for tracking faculty. Okay. No other questions? Nothing? Okay. Now, I lied to you earlier, now that I've got your attention. I told you we were going to go into Chapter 10, and I took a look at some of the material in Chapter 10 and realized we're going to have to cover some of the Chapter 9 material. Chapter 9 is a completely different way of looking at things. Up till now, what we've done is operations on points or small regions, things like derivatives, median filters, and stuff like that. It turns out that there's a whole new class of filters which are based upon connectivity, topology, and set theory. And this is called image morphology. They're very fast. They work exceptionally well with binary images. They can be applied to grayscale images. And I haven't seen very much on color morphology, but I remember one of my master's students did a master's thesis on color morphology back about 1985. There's been some work, but it hasn't been very well followed up to the best of my knowledge. Okay, now, what in the world is all of this image morphology? Well, it's set theory. And we're going to have two sets. And you can think of these as just collections of points in the image. So, for example, the collection of points that fit inside that boundary, that's A. The collection of points that fits inside that boundary, that's B. Now, we can do things like this, and I want to show you the notation a little bit. We're going to take the complement, which means if that's the set A, the complement is everything outside the set. And we designate that with just a complement on it, and we use set notation, and it's the set of all W, that is all XY points, such that W is not included in A. And that's the kind of notation we'll use over and over. And if you read Chapter 9, there's a lot of this kind of stuff. The basic set operations union are pretty, reasonable. You've seen these before. It's just the sum of the two sets. Okay, intersection are only the points that are common in both sets. But I can take the difference of sets, and basically that's a little bit more complicated. By the way, stuff will really get complicated. But basically, when we say A minus the set B, it's going to be A intersect B complement. Okay, so we take the complement of B, that's everything out here, and we intersect it with A, and that's just that set. Okay, so those are just the basic operations. Now, why are we doing image morphology? One of the big things that's going to happen is that this is used for feature extraction. This is used for mapping boundaries of objects. Basically, the output doesn't have to be a full image anymore. And this is what we're going to get into in Chapter 10, which is going to be segmentation. We're grouping stuff by common characteristics. In fact, we can even use morphology for doing texture analysis and all kinds of interesting things. Now, two more operations, but they make perfect sense. At least I think they do, that we'll be using are going to be translation of A by Z. Okay. I don't know. Do you like me to leave the light on when I write or leave it off? Does it matter? Put it on? Okay. Because we'll use the notation A sub Z to indicate that we've translated something. Okay. And usually, but not always, there will be a parenthesis around it, and it's pretty simple. And I want to do some of this notation just so you get the feel for it. And I may throw that symbol in a lot for all. You'll find that there's a lot of symbolism in morphology. MATLAB has morphological operations. Photoshop has none. But you can buy plugins which do have morphological operations. How about ImageJ? Does it have morphological operations or you haven't looked yet? Okay. But for example, here, this is very simple. Take each point A that's in the set A, add Z to it, and all of these are vectors. Everything is two-dimensional, or to be honest, it could be three-dimensional or more. But normally, we're going to do two. Okay? Now, this one, and by the way, just for reference, we put the origin of set A in as there. Okay? So if we add the vector Z, which might be Z1, Z2 to, you know, if this was originally at the origin and we added that Z to it, it shifts it away from the origin. I mean, this stuff has very simple interpretations. The second one, though, is very different. It's the reflection of a set. And this one's really easy because we picked the origin of B right on the corner. Remember what B looked like originally? And it's saying, let's pick the origin of it right up here, this upper left-hand corner. Notice what it looks like here. Basically, what we've done is we've flipped it around the origin. Okay? B equals the set of all W, such that W equals minus B for all B an element of V. Don't worry, I'm not going to get overly carried away with set theory. But if you're interested in it, there are some great references. Okay? Now, just a reminder of some things. We're going to show you some examples. To start with, all of our images are going to be binary. That means all the pixels are going to be values 0 and 1. And to be honest, I think that a lot of the examples have the 0 and 1 backwards from the way we normally did it in image processing so far. Remember, we would always have black being 0 and 1 being white. I think these are flipped in a lot of the examples. So, the background, all the zeros are white, and black is where the object is. So don't get confused. One of the big things is we're going to want to do operations on variables. Okay? And you should have seen all of these. We've got the and, indicated by the dot. The result will only be one if both inputs are one. We've got an or. The result will be one as long as one of the inputs is one. We have the not, which is just flipping it. Okay. In this case, it would be a P. So whenever it's zero, it becomes one. One becomes zero. And the other one, which I don't know why it's not on this table, because it's used in the next example, is the exclusive OR. And if you never remember the exclusive OR, it's an adder. Okay? With no carry. So the exclusive OR would show up as XOR, and what would be the sum of these? Zero. That's what the exclusive OR would be. This would be 1. That's okay. This would be 1. That's okay. What's the sum of these? 2. We're going to be in a binary system. So it's 1 with, it's actually 0 with a carry. So the result of an exclusive OR between those would be 0, 1, 1, 0. Okay. Now, how about doing that with some simple images? Okay. And these are pretty straightforward, but see what I meant? This is black, meaning 1. Okay, actually in most cases it's not going to matter. But in this you flip the set. So a not of that would give you a black outline with a white center. Okay, here we're going to do an and of two sets in the image. Okay, so the idea is only where there's a pixel that's in both sets. Okay, because these are the same image coordinates. Okay, and you can see, well, they overlap only there. And so consequently, only there would there be one. Everything else would be zero. Okay, an OR. Okay, you put these on top of each other. Every place where there is a point that belongs to the resultant set. Okay. An exclusive OR. Okay. If it was zero, it's not going to change. If there's one, one, okay, where it's one here and zero there, it'll be one. Where it's one here and zero here, it'll be one. And where they're both one, it'll become zero. Now, the exclusive OR doesn't have much use other than making examples like this. Okay. And then here's one down here on the bottom. We're going to do the not of A and B. Okay, so we just are going to flip this. So there's our not A. There's our B. Okay. And where are they going to be both one? Up here. And that's exactly what you see there. Now, to be honest, all of this is really not where things really get interesting. This is where things get interesting. Because we have operations, and these, by the way, are great. They have a ton of applications, okay? And we'll probably just get through the four major operations today, or before the end of today. The key thing in image morphology is that we have the original picture, okay? This is usually what we, well, the original object. This is our set, okay? And maybe this is a rectangle in a picture, okay? And you have something called a structuring element. And the whole idea is, how does this relate to this set? It's almost like image processing. What we do is we take the structuring element, we fit its center over every one of the pixels in here. And then what we do is we ask ourselves, do the sets match? Do they not match? And based upon that, we compute a result. Well, dilation is a fairly simple thing. So we take each point in this image, we put the structuring element over it, okay? And what this does is for every point around it, these are all ones, Okay, this is the what the structuring element is doing. So, in big detail, here's our image. I'll put my structuring element right on top, like that. And what this says is fill all of those pixels with one if they weren't already one. Okay? And so I'm going to move this around and put it over every element. As long as there's a one there, I put the structuring element there. That's the key thing. Only the center needs to match in this one. And what that has is the effect that you can see right here, that it's extending the boundary of the object. This is what we call dilate. It's making it bigger. Okay? And this works perfectly well, okay, with square objects. We denote it by the symbol circle with a plus sign in it, and that is the dilation of A by B. Usually the structuring element is always the second element. Now, you don't have to do it with square structuring elements. We're going to primarily use square or round. But if you're looking for something, and you can do some really neat effects, okay, how about a rectangular, a tall and skinny structuring element? Okay? And so, if we have something that's really big vertically, and you can see right away how this is going to work, I move it, put it over this pixel right here at the upper left-hand corner, and see it turns all of those to one. So what it's doing is it's stretching the vertical boundary considerably. It's not doing very much with the horizontal. So, this may have applications. Now, usually we use this. Yes, Phil. Because we always write XOR. And in fact, most of the time we don't write the exclusive OR or anything like that. We'll write it as set operations with an XOR in it. And wait, we're going to have some really interesting more symbols. Everything with a circle. Okay, now this one's great for making things bigger. And what's an application for making things bigger? You may have remembered this. I think we showed it in, I can't remember, I think it was chapter 4, OCR. One of the things is you run a low-pass filter, and basically it smears out a high-resolution OCR, you know, optical character recognition, a scan, and makes it continuous. Well, the problem with that is that if you had an original, just black and white image, the output's grayscale because your filters are all, you know, with coefficients between 0 and 1. Okay? The advantage of a dilation is that the output's binary. It doesn't change yet. So if you're working with binary, it's a big plus. And here we did something different. And this is the reason why we have a variety of structuring elements. Notice, this structuring element isn't, well, it's a 3x3, but the whole idea is instead of that one that I showed you earlier, where it was just full of ones, the whole idea here is what we want to do is we want to enhance for connectivity. We want stuff to be four connected. We're not so much interested in filling diagonal gaps. But if it finds a gap in here, you know, it might be that we come along and maybe there's our letter and there's a gap in there of one pixel. You know, we put this thing that we came up with over there, this structuring element over it, and what does it do? It says, oh, okay, I'm going to it'll be over here. Okay. So what it's doing is it's stretching it like that. Okay. And that would put a one there. And over here, the very same structuring element would put ones there. So it can tend to fill small gaps. Okay? It could be that, you know, if you're trying to deal with yellow lines and stuff, you may want something that fills yellow image segments. And so these are great for filling holes in things, removing holes. Yes? There can be, but those are not for the simple applications. It turns out they're related to thinning, skeletons, or convex hulls. Now, I don't know if any of those words meant anything to you yet, but they will definitely next Tuesday. Okay? But basically, you can take a big object, and, you know, maybe it's complicated, and shrink it down to a skeleton. For example, if you had something like this. It might be possible, instead of having all of these points, to reduce it to that set. It shrinks things. Now, that's not a very complicated one. I remember doing this, again, one of my master's students a long time ago, and that's a dendrite growing on a crystal in zero gravity. Okay, and we came up with the skeleton like that. Okay, later I'm going to show you more mathematically about skeletons, but skeletons are related to multiple, and I haven't gotten to the operation yet, erosions. That's what this slide is. Multiple erosions shrink things down. Multiple dilations make things bigger. And by doing that, you can get rid of features you don't want. You can smooth things. There's all kinds of things. Let me do, okay, the erosion. Okay, since that's a really, really important thing. And by the way, this drawing is wrong. Okay. Basically, it's not to the correct scale. Okay. Because this outer line should be the same size as A. I found that there's actually a number of small errors in the illustrations for Chapter 9. And they weren't updated on the author's website, so I'm a little surprised. So this is the original object, set A. And what we have is structuring element again, that's all ones, a 3x3. Well, just for my simple example over here, it's a 3x3. Over there, it's whatever D by D is. Okay, or actually D over 2 by D over 2. Okay, but the idea is, just like before, we move the center pixel around and put it over. Yes, Bill.
That's right.
Let me finish what it does. Well, it is right. It's just the scale that's wrong. Okay? Because what it does do is, okay, if this doesn't match the set of all ones, I eliminate that point. You see, what we were doing last time was we were adding points. Now, because these are zeros here, and they don't match this one, we're going to remove that point. Okay? We would move it in here. Okay? This matches now. There's all ones around it. We keep that point. So basically, this is a technique for removing points from a set. Okay? And you see, that's where it's wrong. This size right here, the dash, should correspond to that. Because we're removing pixels. and that's called an erosion. Minus for removing. You look perplexed, Bill. Oh, it's still going to be a square and everything, but the key point is that a dilation is adding a ring of pixels. Dilation is removing a ring of pixels. Oh, it'd be right if this were just the same physical size as that. I mean, the drawing is fine. It's just this does not the same scale. This scale should match that scale, not this scale.
The dotted line should be the size of A added with maybe half of B.
Ah, but we're right. But we're starting with A. And what we're actually doing is taking our structuring element around, and when those pixels don't match, we're removing them. So, with D, okay, I put my there's my structuring element. I put it over it. It's not all ones. These sets don't match. I remove that point.
I mean, the way this looks, I mean, the D over A is just the outer boundary of B as it moves all around A. But instead of taking out the center point, they take out all of the area B covers, which would be the D over A.
Yeah, and that's where it's wrong. Because that's not what it's supposed to do. Yes, that's where it's misleading. Now, this is, by the way, this is really neat. Okay, you can do some really cool things with erosion to find stuff. So, if you'll buy my premise that it removes edges, or actually what it does is it removes points where the set does not match the structuring element. That's what it does. Okay. And that's a little bit more complicated. What happens if you take the same set with this rectangular element? Okay. Every place that it doesn't fit inside this set is removed. Every point is removed. And it, since this is D in height and this is D, it doesn't, you see, part of the reason is it didn't put the dimensions in. Okay, so if that's D, think about it. The only place where it's not going to remove points now is when it fits in perfectly. So it would be right there, first point. Move it over one point. What you get is entirely a straight line. That's it. Now this is really neat, because what this actually is it's the set of all centers of objects that look like this. Okay, I can do neat things like, for example, have it look only for narrow, thin objects and images. I can have it remove thin objects. I can have it remove fat objects through a combination of dilation and erosion. Okay, and since I'm running out of time, I'll give you a little guideline for what we'll do next time. Okay? And this is a practical application. Here. A very simple one. Okay. And I can do different kinds of erosion and dilation. Okay. One of the things that I could do is I can erode all of the teeth away, but choosing the right structuring element. So I could erode this into a circle. Okay? And I can then dilate it, now that all the gears have been removed, exactly the same number of, this is where you get into repeating it, like you were asking, Andy. So maybe if I did it 10 times and all the teeth went away, I now come over here and I dilate it 10 times. And what do I get back? I get back this original circle. Now what happens? You subtract the two, and I get just the teeth. And what if there's a beer tooth missing? I just count the number of objects. This is really cool now, where you can start subtracting and adding sets and just get the stuff that you're interested in and throw out everything else. This starts to make it a lot more interesting. Okay, I'm going to show you how you can make things bigger, make things smaller. Boy, that sounds like a TV movie or something. We're going to do some really neat set operations. Now, I'm going to be a little, and by the way, this is doing exactly that. Here's a stellar image or something, and you just want to find these particular square objects and all of that. And what I do is I erode them with an object that's smaller than the biggest one, but bigger than all of the others. All but those three get wiped out. So I eroded it away, but I carefully chose the erosion. Then I dilate it right back to where it was, and bang. You know, maybe this is like finding stars of a certain size, or maybe you're inspecting or sorting stuff. So there's all kinds of cool applications now. Okay. Well, the moral is I want you to really be thinking and actually working on your final projects. You may enjoy turkey Thursday, but since I'm going to be working Thursday, probably grading your papers, it's only fair that you put in some time thinking about your image processing course. So think of image processing when you're cutting that turkey. And I seem to recall, doesn't the Graduate Student Association have like a dinner for grad students or something like next Monday? Not the department, the University Grad Student Association. I think I saw a flyer for that. Anyway, everyone should enjoy at least one day of the weekend